Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce GJ, the CEO of the Wildlife Conservation Network.
Hello, Neil, and hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time to sit down with me. I would love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. How did you first become interested in conservation, and what brought you to work for the Wildlife Conservation Network?
Sure. I was born and raised in Paris, probably next to one of the oldest zoos in Paris, or maybe even in Europe, for Jardin des Plantes. And so from a pretty young age, I had the opportunity to go and see animals in that zoo, and had family members, grandparents, and a father that traveled the world quite a bit. And they would come back from all these travels with stories and pictures. And so from that earliest age, I've always been exposed to nature and travel. Even in France, going out to the mountains, to forests. And as far as I can remember, I've always wanted to do something with animals. I grew up wanting to be a wildlife veterinarian for various reasons. That kept evolving into a number of different things. I then kind of went into wanting to study animal behavior, be an ethologist. That took me to university in the United States. And from that point, I had the opportunity to go on a field course in Peru, in the middle of a rainforest. And I was just blown away by that ecosystem. It was wild, very different from any other travel I had done, which had mostly been limited to probably temperate climates and Europe and North America, these kinds of things. So my Peru rainforest experience was fantastic. I love primates. I saw some monkeys. I didn't speak much Spanish, despite having studied it for a couple of years. I was not very good at Spanish, but I spoke French and English fluently. And so I realized, oh, you know, where else can I be in this kind of ecosystem? Do something with primates where I can actually communicate with people. And so that took me to Central Africa, studying chimps and gorillas, working with a wildlife conservation society at first. And then ultimately, I moved on to work with another organization called the World Resources Institute on a project called Global Forest Watch, documenting where logging was taking place throughout Central Africa. And by the time I realized that took me kind of further and further away from my passion for wildlife, it was really important to be at that nexus between people, animals, and the environment. But I wanted to get back into wildlife itself. So long story short, I took a detour via university. I got myself a PhD along the way. I tried to work for the US government for a very short while, realized that wasn't quite what was suited for me. And about 12 years ago, I learned about the incredible work of a wildlife conservation network. And it felt like a perfect fit for my interest, my skills, my experience. At the time, we were a relatively small organization. I think when I joined, we were 6 or 7 people. And it was right at the point where I could be based in the United States and help support all these conservationists throughout the world. And so it felt like the perfect place for me. And the rest has been history, which maybe we'll get into.
Wow, that sounds absolutely incredible. So you've had conservation deeply ingrained into your bones, effectively from the start. And it sounds like you've been on a incredible, incredible journey that has brought you here. How would you best describe what the Wildlife Conservation Network is to everyone listening here today?
Sure. So the Wildlife Conservation Network is an organization based in the United States, in California. But our mission is to protect endangered wildlife by supporting conservationists who can really ensure that both people and wildlife coexist and thrive throughout the world. And we basically do everything we can to help those conservationists in the field achieve their mission better and faster. We do that through 3 core strategies or approaches. We invest in conservation organizations that are focused on a focal species and that work in sight. We invest in the next generation of conservationists, what we call our rising wildlife leaders, so that it can give them a leg up into the space and enable them to build the connections and the support to stay in the space, because we really need and want conservation for the long term to be implemented by people who are citizens and residents of those regions where that happens.
It's a difficult space to really find success in, because a lot of the work that you do towards it, it's not something that most people would see as financially stable or something that you can find long-term success. And a lot of people, their deep motivators here are passions. It's them wanting to see these animals or causes thrive, and it's really rooted in them personally bringing that, rather than being a lot of funding in NGOs, isn't that?
That's exactly true. And I want to get back to that in a second. I'll tell you a third strategy we do, and then I want to get back to that point. The third strategy is we invest in conservation projects through what we call our wildlife funds. And that allows us to have impact across the entire range of a species. But to get back to your point, I think that's very true. It's really important to invest in people who are passionate, and people get into conservation for any number of reasons. There are many ways to also to contribute in conservation, but it is not a field in which we make a lot of money. And so for some of these really bright and talented minds and individuals throughout the world, but especially in some of the global South, I would say, they have plenty of choices. They could become doctors, lawyers, business people. There are tons of stuff. And they're drawn to the environment. There's lots of pressure for them to do something else. The opportunity is few and far between. So that program, that Rising Wildlife Leaders program, really curates opportunities for those young people to stay in this field, to show that there's a path, to pair them with mentors, to show that there are other people from those countries that have also made this a career, that it is a perfectly acceptable, successful, productive way to contribute to society and to fulfill their passion and their drive. So it's something that's hard, but even in my 25, 30 years in this field, I've seen tremendous changes in the opportunities that are provided to people to make a career in that space.
As there should be. I feel like as time has progressed, we've sort of disconnected from our association to the planet further and further, but there's still those that have that deep ingrained sort of connection and want to pursue it and want to do something with it. But it's about kind of finding those opportunities and organizations and connections that are really able to help you succeed in those manners. I would love to know go ahead.
I was going to say it's amazing how similar we all are. I mean, one question I love to ask conservationists when I meet them, regardless of where they're from Uganda, Mozambique, or Colombia, or Mongolia, you ask them, why do you do this? And they all have a story that relates to something that I'm sure you and I could relate to, a moment when they were a kid that they had an experience with an animal. It could be in an urban setting or in a rural setting, or a parent or a friend who showed them something that opened and awakened that connection. And regardless of where we grew up, regardless of how old we all are, I think we can all relate. For those of us who are concerned about the planet, who care about the environment, who care about wildlife, there's always that one spark, and it's quite universal. And it's something that I'd love to discover from all the people I interact with.
My friend actually sent something to me the other day, and he said, "We are the universe experiencing itself." And it was so profound. And I've been thinking about it ever since he sent it to me, because it relates so deeply to so much of the work that I've done in my past, a lot of work that's going on around communities around the world. But it also makes you really think psychologically and about why we're here and how we interact with the planet, the universe, each other. But we're going to deep dive into a different direction in conversation if we carry down that route. But yeah, so I kind of wanted to go into what the driver behind the creation of the WCN, the Wildlife Conservation Network, was. And how do you operate now? How has it changed and grown in that time?
So WCN was co-founded by three individuals, two of whom had deep ties to Silicon Valley in California, and the third less so, but who had deep and long experience in wildlife conservation. But they all shared this passion for wildlife, for conservation, the belief that you couldn't separate wildlife conservation from the people that shared the landscapes of those animals, and that we needed to better support community-based or community-led conservation. And there are lots of people who do this extraordinary work, but it's really hard to find them. There wasn't a ton of transparency, 20 years ago in the conservation space about finding all those different organizations throughout the world or individuals who were dedicated their lives to ensure that people and wildlife could coexist and thrive. And if you were a philanthropist, it was pretty hard to find out who to give your money to so that it would be used effectively and well. And likewise, if you were one of those individuals working in Zimbabwe or Kenya or Peru, it was pretty hard to find those individuals or foundations who wanted to give money. It limited the space to just a few actors, a few large nonprofit organizations, often based in either Europe or in the United States. And maybe the typical known actors of people who would issue grants or provide support for scientific research. And so our founders felt that there was something there. There was a opportunity to better connect donors, especially in the United States, where they were from, with field-based conservationists and to provide an opportunity for those people to meet. And so it's very much inspired by the venture capital style funding model that's happened here in Silicon Valley in California, trying to identify really key entrepreneurs, conservation entrepreneurs, and vet them and then provide them an opportunity to meet potential funders and let the magic happen. And that's a big part of WCN. And so it started off with a focus on a handful of individuals. We ultimately, over time, realized that individuals are great. They're founders. They're the energy behind it. We can only do so much as individuals, so you need an organization. So our support over the past 20 years has shifted to providing support to organizations, but with strong leaders, with an S. I mean, it's important to have a team. And we started with six organizations. Today, we have 26 conservation partners that form the core of our network, and we provide opportunities for them to connect with the philanthropists to feature their work. A big part of it is giving them a voice, because it's so hard for those people to get access. And so we organized something called an expo, which I'm happy to talk about later, that gives a platform for those conservationists to come and share their work and for philanthropists to come and meet them. We also then realized we needed to do more than just providing support to those conservation organizations working in a handful of sites. And there are opportunities to try to address the threats that were affecting species across the entire range of those species. And that's where the concept of the wildlife funds came through. And we first started with the Elephant Crisis Fund, and we can talk about these other funds. But if you think about it, maybe in a more investments sense, Our partner network is very much like individual companies or organizations that people develop a close association with and they want to support them. But there are some people who just know that they care about rhinos and they want to support rhinos. And so they can invest in the Rhino Recovery Fund. And we have a fund manager that does all the due diligence for all the right projects. And so we can then disperse the funding to all those projects across the whole range of that species. And then the third element is the one we were talking about earlier, is realizing that if we want to do this in the long haul, we also need to invest in the next generation, and so providing that opportunity. So it covers it throughout all those three lenses.
Fantastic. I am super excited to dive into everything that the WCN has been involved in. But for now, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be back soon.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with GJ, the CEO of the Wildlife Conservation Network. So we kind of just heard how the WCN has holistically worked and adapted over the years in bringing together NGOs in the ways they function and in the ways that they effectively raise capital for the work that they're trying to achieve. I think off the back of that, I would really like to know about some of the most critical threats that are facing wildlife today, and how can we address them collectively? I know you already mentioned in terms of funding, that's a big aspect. It's always going to be an aspect of NGOs.
So yeah, I'll wrap up on the funding piece. I think one piece that's also really important that's often not happening is making sure that the money flows effectively to those organizations. One of the unique characteristics of WCN is that we can guarantee that if donors designate their funding to a particular species, 100% of that funding will go to that species. And we fundraise for our own needs separately from that. So that's a pretty important distinguishing characteristic that ensures that people who really want their money to go and be put on the ground, every dollar that they put in, or every hundreds of thousands of dollars that they put in, we love big and small donation, that goes on the ground. If they say, hey, I wanted to go to elephants, I wanted to go to painted dogs, I wanted to go to cotton-top tambourines. But you're right, all of that.
So there's transparency there with the WCN. If I know I want to donate to the Rhino Fund, all of my $1,000, my $100, my $10 is all going directly to that fund that I'm investing in. There's no trickle-down effect of me putting in $1,000 and them actually getting $100.
That's right. If you go on our website, which I'm sure you could link in the notes, but it's www.wildnet.org, people can pick the project they want to support. And then in addition, if they want to support WTN itself so that we can do all the vetting and all that work, they can do something in addition, but we don't take it off the top. So people can really designate it fully. Let's get back to why we want to get money out to the ground, because the important part, you're right, is we want to make sure that people and wildlife can coexist and thrive and that we can have a healthy planet. And so there are lots of threats right now that are affecting wildlife. And a lot of that, I think, is driven by human activity, but I think the solutions also lie in human activity. So some of the key threats are probably things many people have heard about before. It's habitat loss being one of those leading issues because there's a lot of land conversion for agriculture, for infrastructure, for urban development that leaves animals without the space that they need to survive, or it brings animal and people in too close proximity that can lead to conflict. It can lead to disease exchanges. I think we've all had, unfortunately, a couple of years where we've experienced some of that. So there's an important part that is connected to that habitat loss that leads to that encroachment, so that we have a conflict over resources that become increasingly scarce. Climate plays a key role in this. I mean, we've got a changing climate. We've seen more intense fires, more intense droughts, more intense floods. And so all of that kind of pushes human populations and wildlife to different edges. It makes competition for resources more fierce. It leads to human-to-human conflict, sadly, but it also leads to human and wildlife conflict. I also get quite depressed by human greed. I mean, I think people are also driven by greed for various wildlife product. Sometimes that greed is out of pure necessity. People need to feed themselves, need to feed their family, but sometimes it also takes excessive commercial natures. And so there's a pretty vibrant wildlife trade for different species. But in the case of pangolins, for instance, or in the case of rhinos, or as was the case a couple of years ago for elephants, the desire for ivory, for rhino horn, for pangolin skins, for various pelts from other animals has also driven some of these species close to extinction. And our efforts is to try to pull on the brake and try to reverse that.
You've touched on some really key points there. I think, yes, the greed of many, particularly Western-based societies that have been driving a lot of these issues. I think relating back to issues like desertification and flooding causing changes, often out of our eyesight. I'm here based in London, but a lot of the times when I go to the stores, our food is mostly imported. But the imports are coming from countries where they may not necessarily, where it's not necessarily in my eyesight, my eye view of knowing exactly what's going on there. But they are often at the forefront of these environmental issues. With that being said, oftentimes these communities kind of know what to do, or they'll have more rooted ideas in indigenous culture. How does WCN ensure that local communities are also at the forefront of conservation efforts? You know, that their knowledge and expertise is being valued and applied, and also kind of counteracting what has been a prevalent issue with NGOs in the past of this quote-unquote white savior complex?
That's a great, great question. And I think it's really important for us to recognize the power of locally based solutions. And that's why we invest really in organizations that are local. We invest in individuals that are rooted in those countries. We've seen the benefits, and there's been plenty of evidence that shows that indigenous peoples and local communities know how to manage their resources. They can put protections in place. There are lots of pressure in a number of different contexts, but it's really, really valuable and essential for us to be listening to people who have been living in close proximity to wildlife and in those landscapes. They depend on that healthy ecosystem. They're the first sufferers of the losses of those ecosystems experience. We ultimately suffer from it, but kind of a couple levels down in that cascading effect. So for us, when WCN was founded, and it remains a really important principle to be investing in locally led conservation, because those individuals, they know the culture, they know the dynamics, they know the social context, they know what works. If something is not working, they can pick it up way faster than I can pick it up thousands of miles away. So it's linked to that transparency I was talking about earlier. It's we want to get the money out to the ground, because it's those organizations that are straight on the ground that are the most apt, able, and quickest to respond to these shifting conditions. And they can rely on thousands of years of history. Unfortunately, I think we're seeing an erosion of our connection to nature as a human society. And I think that erosion is true for, you know, me growing up as a kid in Paris, or you in London, or me now in Berkeley, California, as well as some people in various countries outside of urban centers. So I think there's a big effort to try to bring education at all levels so that people get reconnected to nature, an effort to try to make sure that people benefit from nature, from healthy ecosystems, from the wildlife that they live in. A couple of examples where we see that happening in Colombia, we've got a partner called Proyecto TT working to protect the Comtop tamarin. And they've been working really closely with women-led cooperatives to generate some income so that people can understand the benefit of the cleaner environment. It started off with removing trash bags out of the environment. And from removing all those trash bags that were polluting the forest and presenting various threats to the wildlife living there, the women would, not sure it's the right term, would crochet or knit bags. They call them eco-machillas. And so you could take those bags and use them for a number of purposes. And they become quite trendy. Actually, some of them have become quite high-end. But that's provided real income for these women. And it gave them an opportunity to aspire to other things in life, send their kids to school. They can work in their communities rather than having to work in urban centers. Similar things have happened in Peru.
The one that you just mentioned, and you just mentioned Peru as well. So these are both organizations associated with WCN, right? They're some of your partners, correct?
That's correct.
With the partnering system of these NGOs working under WCN, do you think there's an ease of sort of knowledge transfer because of that?
There's an ease of knowledge? What do you mean?
For example, let's say you have two different NGO organizations working on similar species, or in terms of the ways that they operate in terms of monitoring or conservation efforts, or they're doing habitat restoration a certain way, and it can then be applied to another species or another organization that's working somewhere else internationally. Working together under WCN, is there a sort of ease of knowledge transfer in that sense? And then saying, hey, we're doing this, you guys know, maybe tell these guys over here.
Very, very much so. And some of it happens without our control. So we bring our conservation partners together once or twice a year, and we give them this platform for them to share their stories with philanthropists. But on the back end of it, we also organize training workshops for them. And over the years, we've also been able to do that online. And the power of a network is so extremely rich. So what was at first an idea of let's connect conservationists with philanthropists and let's facilitate this money exchange, when we started getting these conservationists together, which at first was just six and now it's 26, we realized, wow, there's a lot of value in just getting these people in the same room. And even more so, sometimes we are able to facilitate for them to go and visit each other, because when they share a campfire and they spend like 3 or 4 days together in camp in the bush, suddenly they realize, hey, I do this way. Oh, I have that same challenge. And they learn so much. And we've even brought some new partners.
It's just making me smile so much, because I was like, it's just so like beautiful to hear like all of these people coming together with such a passion of being like, yeah, like I started doing these with sea turtle nesting areas. And someone's like, what, you did what? And I can just imagine like how like exciting and enthralling these conversations are for all of these people, because I think we're all kind of kids at heart when it comes to conservation.
We are. They're all passionate. They all want to do something. At first, I think a lot of people got into this because they're passionate about a place or an animal. And then they realize, well, we need to do something to protect it. And so then it shifts into like problem solving. And so they're all trying different things. And then they realize, hey, somebody else has tried that same thing. I don't need to reinvent the wheel. Even down to the names, we brought some organizations on, and some of a newer organization. I was mentioning the one in Peru, Spectacle Bear Conservation. And he said, oh yeah, I've been watching a number of WCN partners. And in fact, you know, I was even inspired for the name of our organization by this other organization, Cheetah Conservation Botswana. And this is a Peruvian organization looking at a Botswanian organization. And then when they meet, they can talk about what they do. We've had fantastic success from some of our partners with the Cheetah Conservation Fund, Cheetah Conservation Botswana, implementing livestock guard dogs and to prevent depredation of livestock to cheetahs in that case. But that technique was then also adopted in South America to protect depredation from pumas, or in this case, they were working to protect Andean cats. A lot of the farmers thought that, you know, maybe cats were, Andean cats were the culprits. It turned out they weren't. There were other species involved, but nonetheless, the livestock were still being preyed upon by larger carnivores. And so these livestock guarding dogs were adapted and implemented in a different place. And so you get a lot of those exchanges of what can be done in one country or another. And of course, you need to tweak it a little bit, but it's really fascinating to provide that platform for exchange. That's true for monitoring, that's true for engaging communities, that's true for messaging, communication, telling your story better to different groups of people.
I think it speeds up the learning curve of conservation, of when you're starting initiatives or you're dealing with kind of hurdles that you're coming across. By having this cross-exchange, this access of information, it really allows you to like push through those barriers so much quicker. And I think moving into like the digital age changed a lot of that and allowed that to adapt and move a lot quicker, which I definitely want to get into later. But everything you've mentioned so far is super inspirational. And I think I kind of want to know what are some of the most inspiring stories of wildlife resilience and recovery that you've witnessed.
There's a lot. I mean, I think hope is really important. We can't give hope.
That's why we're here. We're here for hope, guys. Come on.
And people ask me, I mean, if I was not hopeful, I would not be in this line of work. And I think that's true for all the people who do this. And what gives me the most hope is when I meet people on the front line. It's conservationists, it's communities who are really finding creative solutions to try to reverse some of these negative trends. You do find stories, inspiring stories of resilience in many places. Saiga Conservation Alliance, and you may have seen this recently, but the Saiga antelope was on the brink of extinction. But thanks to 2 decades of dedicated conservation work by the Saiga Conservation Alliance and their partners, the population of saigas has rebounded to about 1.9 million individuals, and I think maybe even higher than that. The government, NGOs, various research organizations really worked together for more than 20 years to put anti-poaching measures in place, to improve habitats, to monitor the populations, to engage communities. And that's been very successful, to the point where the Saiga antelope was reclassified from being critically endangered to being near threatened by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. So that signifies a global recovery for that species. It doesn't mean that we don't need to do anything anymore for it. It means that whatever we've been doing are the right kinds of things that we're doing, and we need to continue doing them. But it shows that when we do those things, success can happen, and we are on that positive trend. In Rwanda, we have one of our partners called the Rwanda Wildlife Conservation Association, and they've been conducting annual censuses of gray crowned crane populations for the past 7 years in Rwanda. And when they formed in 2014, the population of crane in that country was only between maybe 50 and 300 individuals. And through the work of RWCA with the government, with various anti-poaching efforts, with education campaigns, monitoring the population, the number of wild crane has increased every year since that first census, and nearly doubled the original count since their work began. So there's another sign of hope. Similarly, in Argentina, we have a partner called the Global Penguin Society that's been working in a marine protected area around Pedral. And what they started off with 6 breeding pairs of penguins, through several years of conservation work, of protection, managed to secure the area more and more. And they now have, I think, 4,000 breeding pairs of a penguin in that colony, which is fantastic successes of recovery. The list does go on. I do want to mention the other really, one that's very personal and linked to some of our strategies, is with regards to elephants. We launched an elephant crisis fund in partnership with Save the Elephants at a time where elephants were particularly under threat and from a demand for ivory. Over the years, we saw a huge, in the 2010s through 14, 15, tens of thousands of elephants were being killed for their tusks, driven by that demand for ivory, largely in China and throughout other parts of Asia. And through the collaboration of many NGOs, putting efforts on stopping the killing and stopping the demand and stopping the trade, it led to a major turning point in 2016 when China actually implemented a near total ban on domestic ivory trade. And so through that and the ongoing strength of law enforcement, public awareness, the ivory-driven poaching has drastically reduced. And that's been a huge success, something that's very inspirational. But again, when we work together across many NGOs, we don't really care who gets the credit for what, because all of these different NGOs work together to make that turnaround. It's quite fantastic. Doesn't mean, again, that elephants are not under threat, but the biggest threats probably now are related to what we were talking about earlier with human-elephant conflict, with encroachment being closer together. So there are tons of work being done on how we can better live closer to elephants, which are not easy neighbors. But mm-hmm. I think we all deserve to have some space, both human populations and elephants. And so there's lots of really creative ways to ensure that elephants and people can coexist in the landscapes across Africa and Asia. Plenty of lessons there. So.
Honestly, incredible. You've highlighted some fantastic positive stories there, and positive stories with so much successes. And you're right, the journey's not over yet, but it doesn't mean you can't celebrate the wins that have been had. And on that note, we'll be right back after this short break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with GJ, the CEO of the Wildlife Conservation Network, the WCN. So we just left off on GJ telling us all of these amazing successes that the WCN and their partners have had over the past 5 years to a decade plus in various conservation movements around the world. We mentioned briefly in the early part of the show the movement towards the digital space and how that kind of adapted and changed the way that NGOs functioned in their communication and the way that they were able to progress in their work. On that note, I really want to know what you think about growing technological advancements and how they work or play into modern conservation efforts. I'm hearing about so much technology all the time that is being implemented internationally by different NGOs and how they're using them to protect endangered species. But I feel like you're going to be able to give me real key insight as to how your partners and the WCN have seen these progress.
I think there's lots to learn from lots of different kinds of organizations. And I might take us full circle in some of this, but you
know, take us wherever.
Technology is really transforming our conservation efforts in different ways because it can bring new opportunities to protect wildlife, to protect habitats, to communicate with each other. And so if we integrate some of these cutting-edge tools and approaches, we can try to be more precise, be more efficient, be more adaptable with the conservation solutions we put in place, be even more informed and proactive. At the same time, we also have to always listen to the needs of the people on the ground. And we can't use technology as a hammer in search of a nail. We've got to find the proper problem and make sure that the solution is fit for that problem, not be shopping around a solution and that we look which problem can be applied to. So we've got to listen to the needs of the communities, the needs of the wildlife conservationists, and make sure that the technology is properly matched. But, you know, there's been tons of things that are quite advanced, sophisticated, that help wildlife monitoring, would it be with drones, with satellite tracking, putting collars on animals, camera traps, artificial intelligence enabling us to more efficiently monitor species. Some of these tools can also be deployed to know where some of these animals are and be be better protected. Some of these tools can be put in place to determine where poaching hotspots might be happening and be more effective in deploying anti-poaching patrols. Some of these tools can be deployed to survey very remote areas or survey them more efficiently. So instead of being, you know, in Zimbabwe, we have a partner who protects dogs, and they've got a fantastic team that monitors these dogs to know where they are, and they're individuals. And one in particular goes out in his truck and has, I don't know if you've ever seen these, but it's pretty old school. You pull out.
Is this with the painted dogs?
The painted dogs. Yes. Painted dog conservation in Zimbabwe. And so they have, you know, it's an antenna. It's a pretty small antenna. It's kind of that you hold up above your head. It's got four rods, and it picks up signs from the collars of the animals. And then you have to drive to different points to triangulate and figure out where the animals are. Well, sometimes you want to drive from point A to point B, and there's like a big gulch or a gully or a forest you can't cross over. But they're experimenting with deploying drones that could go up and fly above that and go to those different paces and send those pings. So you could triangulate much faster, and it's much more efficient. It's less costly. You don't have to spend as much gas, et cetera, et cetera. So some of these things are happening, and it doesn't happen overnight. So there's a lot of technological tweaking that happens, but it's certainly there. There could be some real-time tracking of animals, almost real-time tracking of infractions. So there could be some pings that go off if poachers enter a particular area. That could be pings that go off when an animal with a collar enters a particular area that's close to a community, and that warns our communities, you know, elephants are about to crop our field. We should go and make some noise and try to move them away. And that actually takes me to something, that's where I go full circle. There are some pretty simple tools that can also be done. So we're talking about coexistence. Our partner at Save the Elephants have been testing for years, and they just published a big paper of multiple years of data from tons of sites across Africa about the effectiveness of these beehive fences. So elephants, not all elephants, but many elephants do not like being stung by bees, just like you
they
and I. And so they get spooked.
They hear
the buzzing and they go away. And so by putting out fences of these wooden beehives around particular fields, when elephants come through, they might trigger the beehive. The bees would fly out. The elephants suddenly hear them, and they know that's not where they want to be, and they leave. And so that's a very, very simple tool.
Yeah,
and our partners.
That's interesting. That's almost like the integration of nature and technology there. Yeah, that's
it. Is
that is fantastic.
Even opportunities for people. So, you know, people can sell the honey and do a number of things. And there are other crops that can be used. There are crops that elephants don't like that can be planted on the outside of crops that elephants do like. So those crops that elephants don't like still could have some commercial value. But what's really great, where it goes full circle, is Save the Elephants have developed this toolbox to deal with human-elephant conflict, with 80 different kinds of strategies that have been tried and piloted around Africa. But it's hard for people to have access to all of those technologies. And so they've also worked with an organization called WildAid, who's developed a WhatsApp-based chat box where farmers can go on their phone on WhatsApp, which a lot of people have access to, put information in the chat box as to what their problem is. And the chat box pulls from all those solutions and tells them, have you tried this or that? So that's being developed and tested right now. Well, that's a great marriage of technology, AI, WhatsApp, chatbox, and then practical, low technology needs solutions such as planting crops or beehive fences or any number of other things.
That blows my mind, actually. Wow. I left me speechless for a second. I was like getting super eager to ask my next question as well, and you kind of fed into it perfectly. Because we're moving into a space that's completely dominated by AI and biotech, and that chatbot is obviously a good utilization of AI. How do you envision the future with these integrations of AI and biotech? And how do you think it will change conservation and how we operate in that sphere?
I think if I knew how it would change it, I'd be a very rich man, and I could probably support conservation in a very different way. So,
I want to keep if AI was being really built by conservationists, it would probably take a completely different route than it is.
Maybe. I think there's some real interesting opportunities there. And I think the key part is, as I mentioned, to continue to talk to each other. So to have all the people working on the technology to really talk to all the people who are working on the front line where that technology might be applied. Sometimes we realize we don't speak the same language, and it's really difficult to have those fruitful exchanges. Even myself, sometimes I have conversations with engineers. I have a really hard time to understand what they do and the application of their work to the field. So
people,
it takes, I think,
minds, they work differently. So
they do. So it takes really open mind and exchanges. Ideally, people can go visit each other. They can see the realities on the ground so that they can think, oh, what I've been thinking about in my lab, or thinking about just in my studio and trying to design. This is how I need to adapt it when I meet the people who are going to use it, or I meet the environment it's going to be deployed in, or all these models. You really do need to ground truth it. But I think computing power now is getting so intense that we can fast track a lot of that learning. And there are some really interesting opportunities still with elephants. There's some artificial intelligence and drone pairing that is helping us better study elephant behavior. We've known a lot about animals. I think one of the focus of Wildlife Conservation Network is to focus on organizations that protect animals. But science is still key. It's fascinating to be learning animal behavior for the sake of animal behavior. That's what I got into in the first place. But we don't have the time to just do that. We have to do that and pair it with, okay, what is that going to mean for management, for conservation? And I think that's where those exchanges are really key. But there are tons of things that we can keep on learning and then applying for management purposes.
Well, maybe one day there will be an ideal world where conservation isn't needed and we can just spend all our time just studying the animals and figure out, I wonder what elephants are doing at night in that forested area. They've been there for a little while. Let's figure out what's going on.
That'd be lovely.
Yes, that would, wouldn't it? Where do you personally see the future of conservation? You personally, where do you see the future of conservation?
Personally, I see the future of conservation in people. I mean, I think it is really about finding a way for people to
live the life
that they want to live in harmony with nature. I deeply believe that we need nature. We need nature for a number of reasons. We all depend on pretty basic things: clean air, clean water, food. That all comes from Mother Earth. So we need to care for that. I think we need nature on a spiritual, cultural level, whatever motivates people. But I think we are inherently wired to be connected to nature in a non-material way, in a more
emotional way.
And I think it's very important to continue that connection. And if
we are the universe experiencing itself.
That's right.
Your friend said that. And so I think the future of conservation really lies in our understanding that if we don't listen to the people who are living on the edges of nature, close to nature, if we don't listen to the people who have been removed from nature that might live in urban settings but still care about the environment, if we don't listen to them and their needs, then we are not going to succeed, and it's going to be a very bad scenario for the entire planet. So we've got to go and listen to all those people in the front line, understand their needs, find ways to help that harmony between people and nature. And if we do that, I think there's a future for wildlife, there's a future for healthy ecosystems, and that means healthier people. Now, there's this concept, and I don't think that's the future, but I think it's part of a future. There's this concept of One Health that looks at the health of people, of livestock, of wildlife, and how it's all interconnected. And so I think we've got to stop siloing our solutions, because the problems are coming at us all at once, and so we've got to find solutions that are equally complex and interconnected, and realize that it isn't just going to take one thing, it's going to take a lot of different things and some tweaking over time.
TJ, I could talk to you for hours, but unfortunately we are running so tight on time, and I guess I would love to end on what message of hope and encouragement you would like to share with our listeners today, and where they can find out more about yourself and the WCN.
Well, I'll start with that, because that's a piece I'm likely to forget, and I want to end on this message of hope. So people can find out more about the Wildlife Conservation Network on our website. So it's www.wildnet.org. We are on a numerous social media platform, on Facebook, on Instagram, and through us you can have access to all of these partners I've mentioned, these wildlife funds. So whether it's a Painted Dog Conservation or Ewasso Lions in Kenya or Proyecto TT in Colombia or the Elephant Crisis Fund, you can get links to all of that, and you can follow any and all of these organizations and projects on any social media platform that you want. I know it might be hard for audiences outside of California, but anybody's always welcome to participate in our Wildlife Conservation Expo that we host here in California in October. We're hoping to do a little bit more in other
Where in California is the expo?
In San Francisco.
Typically.
We're hoping to take that model on the road elsewhere in the United States. In my wildest dream, I hope we come to Europe and other parts of the world. We also have
We'd love to have you.
It'd be great. We have all of those on our YouTube channel, so people can also watch all these pretty short presentations on YouTube, and it's free and easily accessible. And people can reach out to us anytime, and we're happy to answer questions. And what gives me really hope to me is seeing the people on the ground, as I mentioned earlier, especially the next generation, step up and engage in conservation. The future of conservation to me really depends on choices that we make as individuals. And it's the choice of a child growing up in a community next to a national park deciding that they're going to become a park ranger, or deciding they're going to become a wildlife vet, or maybe they ultimately become minister for the environment. Who knows? And it's seeing that drive and that interest from those individuals that really gives me hope. And it isn't just out there. It's the same thing here. It's people who may be thousands of miles removed from wildlife, who may never see an elephant because they're growing up in Berkeley or in London, but who really care that that elephant has a place to live in harmony with its human neighbors, and recognize that, you know, the threats affecting that elephants might be the same threats that are affecting some of our local species here in terms of how we treat each other, how we treat our streams, how we treat the quality of our air. So all the choices that we make as consumers really have an impact. And for people to get a little more engaged in some of those choices, going to the store and watching what they buy in terms of where it comes from and whether things have been sustainably harvested. And sometimes it might cost a little bit more money, but I think that's money well spent. All those kinds of choices, when I see people making them, when I hear kids talking about their concern for the planet, climate, for how other people are being treated, that gives me hope. I think we're naturally wired for good. And so the next generation, I think, is going to do well, but we need to hand them something that is still salvageable. And that's what I'm working really hard to do, is pass them on an earth that's still got some future in it. And we'll get there.
Incredible. Incredible, Jijé. Thank you so much for joining me here today. And thank you all for listening to Our Altered World today. If you enjoy the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, ouraltedworld.com. where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.
Thank you.